I'm James Shoemaker, one of the course authors. I'm in charge of maintaining first 2 days of this week, and I'm also co-author of 699, the Advanced Purple Teaming class with Eric Van Bugenhout, that is debuting shortly. And I've been teaching for SANS since about 2006, and I actually got started on the forensic side. I was doing more investigative style work. I formed a little boutique company in Long Beach, California. We still keep it small. There's only five of us. That way we can get to do things like this. But we get to, you know, be real picky on the projects. We get to pick the fun things to work on because we don't have to deal with long-term consequences. As time went on, our forensic stuff kind of morphed into, we get this request. You know how you found out who broke into the WordPress website? Can you go and see that it's okay now? We think we fixed it. And it's kind of naturally grew into assessments. And so we mostly do like assessments and then manage security services. Like we help people when they, clients we work with, when they get overwhelmed, a little too busy doing day-to-day operations. And then they, they get like a new security vendor product they have to implement or rebuild something. We kind of help them supplement their IT department in sort of a blue team-ish and still a third-party perspective, devil's advocate adversary sort of a way. So that's one reason we like to do stuff like purple teaming kind of concepts. And that's one thing I do with my approach to pen testing still, is more of a not just let me break it, but what do we do about it kind of a thing. So that's a little bit about me. I've also love CTF challenges, have for many years. Started NetWars in 2009. That was a fun thing back a long time ago. It's not the same thing anymore, but had a lot of fun doing that and other things too. So a little bit about me on that. Big fan of, I'll tell you later, big fan of PowerShell and some of the things we do today is very, very fun. Things that I wanted to focus on, stuff I do at every assessment, basically 90%, 95% of the time, as kinds of things we do this afternoon. This morning, we have to also do some crypto. And when I say have to, it would not be a good course if we didn't pick at crypto a little bit. It's a lot easier than people think to pick on crypto. And we'll get into it very shortly. But, well, we start looking at things like, our man in the middle is not working, or the website's got some crypto, or we broke into the website and things are encrypted. But we're just short on time. We only have so much time in our assessment. We might not be able to sufficiently reverse engineer everything to get the win as far as a pen test. So when we look at stuff like crypto this morning, keep in mind that we do celebrate those small wins. Like we might be able to say, you know what, this is not as secure as it could be. Not that we broke it, but here's some advice on how to make it better. To make it things like this application that you're assessing last 10 or 20 years, or data that it's encrypting and protecting 10 or 20 years instead of, five or something like that. Keep in mind those little things make a big deal, even if it's not, hey, I got Rochelle. It's still we're improving the security of the situation. So that's a little bit of a thing to keep in mind as we progress here. After this, we'll get back into some more network attacks as far as a little bit of post-exploitation, even a little bit of graphical. We'll do some math-related stuff, even though I don't think it's that in-depth of math, the things we do today. We won't be breaking the, algorithms themselves, but we're looking at implementation details when it comes to crypto first. So a little bit of a fun morning as far as, again, they're small wins, but they're also easy wins when it comes to looking at real-world applications. And so we'll dive in. And roughly, kind of depends on if there's a lot of discussion or something dramatically breaks today, but probably before lunch, we will get to the point where we'll start switching gears into something a little more visual, as far as breaking out of restricted environments like a kiosk or a really well-hardened desktop, for example, is where we'll start before lunch, and then continuing on with the rest of our post-exploitation the rest of the day, And I'm sure Steve mentioned it yesterday, but the boot camp tonight is basically a little mini CTF just designed to kind of tie together some of the concepts we've been talking about in a live server environment, a real Active Directory, multiple servers, things going on. And it's a little bit of a fun way to tie together, not just today, but give you an opportunity to practice things from yesterday if you like. For example, you can do the whole CTF over IPv6 if you wanted to. And some other things like that. So, kind of a fun thing, to do tonight. A little bit extension of what we've done today. Also too, if you do want something to study during lunch or something, and you've not done any PowerShell before, I encourage you to at least check out the appendix. There's a couple different things, a little sampling of what I think of as PowerShell essentials for pen testers. It is Microsoft's task management automation language. We'll talk more about it later, but it's not going away. It's been here for 10 years, and it's going to stick around. So we'll get into that at the time comes. But if you're foreign to that whole idea, haven't got into it because you've been, I don't know, like some of us stuck in our earlier programming languages, I imagine Steve probably mentioned, because he always loves to tease me about it, but I'm one of those people who can't unlearn Perl. And although I try to do things in Python, I have to think about how I do it in Perl and everything. And I love PowerShell because I can think about things in Perl and actually write it, and it makes sense in PowerShell and actually looks better than it does in Perl. But anyway, first step is admitting it, like they say. Anyway, let's dive into some crypto before I divulge all of my insecurities. Like I already started saying, very essential, but I find often overlooked. I think about it this way too, since there's so many different things that can go wrong in the defense of an organization. When it comes to going through and identifying something to fix, an assessment, penetration test, we don't always get the opportunity to dive into the crypto. And that's one reason I stress that it's so important. And also, it's easy because people don't look at it that much. It's easy to find little things they did wrong. Even if you can't break the entire system, you can still find things that need to be improved. I mean, think about our normal, you know, assessment situation. Whether you're an external organization, like I'm a third party coming in and giving a pen test, or it's you're part of your team doing your regular assessments, you have a small window of time, right? You don't have a lot of time. There's all the scanning you have to do. There's all the stuff you have to do, configuration review, lots of other trial and error things with scanning and exploitation attempts. And do you have time to study the math, you know, as far as finding something? I find that especially coming in as an independent into an organization to do an assessment, they've never really taken a good look at the crypto. They've been told by whoever they outsource development to or the commercial software they're using, the vendor's been telling them, hey, it's encrypted, it's using AES, you know, standard encryption, but, you know, how did they really do it? Did they do it right is a big question. So we're going to talk a little bit about how you would do that, literally essential assessment, like how strong does the crypto look, and then is there some implementation details we can pick at? We'll cover a few basic tools and do a little bit of cryptanalysis. Not, again, enough to turn you into cryptographers. The idea is to, again, in the application, be able to pick out those little details that might be either directly exploitable in some way, or maybe it's just, like, again, that thing you can say, it could be a little bit better. Let's make it a little bit better on the crypto. As I was saying, a lot of people skip over it because there's other things that are more shiny to go through an attack, which also means that there is a lot of nuggets there. There's a lot of good things we can find if we just look. Okay, so look at some. We do tend to celebrate tiny wins. It doesn't seem like, you know, hey, I got a root shell, you know, type of excitement. But when you start picking this through, you can see how some of these things are pretty easy to see if you only choose the right way to view it. And we'll look at some examples and some histogram analysis to kind of, again, highlight the weaknesses. All right, so we're not saying that everybody's going to, you know, find that this new version of the OpenSSL library is vulnerable to some remotely executable situation, although those have, you know, surfaced in the past few years as some of those libraries have gotten more attention, but we're really looking more about those implementation details. Oh yeah, I did AES, but I hard-coded the password, and I did a pretty weak implementation. That's the kind of thing we're looking at. Especially if we look at somebody who has an application or a device and that thing, whatever it is, they've chosen to do their own crypto and they follow a standard mostly. You know, those are the situations we're looking at. They decide that, well, we're going to be real sneaky and secretive and we're not going to quite do AES the normal way. We're going to do it a little differently so attack tools won't work. You know, and they end up making it more insecure because they do something out of that standard, out of bounds, basically. All right, so proprietary wireless, very common for things like this. I'll actually pull up a screenshot from an assessment I did not too long ago when the time comes, kind of show you, yeah, it's encrypted, but it's almost the same. So kind of a scary situation to be in, assuming it's protected and not. But this could be anything from down to a field in a database or a field in a web form, in a protocol, something's getting transferred, like a transport situation, or something stored. All of these things would apply to our situation we're talking about. First, a little bit of clearing out some of the bad information you may have learned or never really focused on those details. We need to do some definitions. Stream ciphers literally encrypt one bit at a time. The idea is it's not just dynamic content, but it's unknown length, potentially, it's going to have something that we can treat as a key that's actually used for encryption. But there is whatever magic, whatever complexity is in the encryption algorithm, it is going to happen to generate a temporary key or a pseudo-random key that we call the key stream, and that actually does the encoding, literally just XORing that with the thing. The thing we're encrypting, right? The plain text. So since it's one bit at a time, if we have, in this example, 63 bytes of plain text to encrypt, we would see the resulting 63 would be the same length of the ciphertext. So if you see something with an odd number, you could assume it's pretty safely that it's a stream cipher. But again, there's a lot of vendors out there who do weird things to their encryption and applications to try to cheat and make things look weird just so you don't recognize what it is. A little bit of trial and error and you might figure that out, as well as today and even tomorrow when you guys will be covering more of the product security testing ideas in general. You'll basically be able to infer a lot of things if you look up some standards. Even if we can't see that this device that we are curious about actually uses a stream cipher or uses a different key length or whatever, we might be able to look up FCC IDs, patents of other things that the same people who made this thing or other people make similar things even. If we have nothing else to work on, we can look and see what kinds of things happen. For example, if there's a proprietary wireless thing, pretty common, not just for WEP, but using RC4. Even Mimikatz loves to use RC4 because since the Kerberos ticket stuff especially is easier to crack in the RC4 version than the AES, we take advantage of that as much as we can, whether you realize you're doing it or not with Mimikatz, especially with the Kerberosing. That comes into play quite a bit. But yeah, if a vendor wanted to, you know, cheat and modify WEP, so it was kind of not WEP. It was WEP, but since WEP is insecure, they just tweak it a bit so it doesn't look like it's WEP. You know, that's the kind of thing we're considering we might look for. Of course, WEP RC4 is really it's like it was designed to be a classroom talking point. All of the things that can go wrong in WEP, it was like a perfect case study of bad choices. It's not that RC4 is really weak. It's just, it's not as good for most of the implementations as we have for something else. Remember, the idea with crypto too is, keep in mind fundamentally, we just want to protect something as long as that thing that we're protecting has value. You know, so we're not going to have something encrypted that's going to be protected forever, but it's going to be 10 years, it's going to be 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, whatever it is, that's what it needs to be. So sometimes RC4 is still okay. I just kind of wanted to point that out, that it's not that RC4 is weak, it's that it's been implemented weekly. Weekly, yeah, not periodically, weekly, like 4 times in a month, like daily, yes. It just sounded weird when I verbalized that, but anyway, implemented poorly, there we go, in a weak fashion. but maybe it's good enough for your particular application. So, you know, again, we'll look at the details of an application before we decide if RC4 is bad for that. Not just RC4 being evil. A51, EO, examples of other stream ciphers. A51 is, we have GSM and Bluetooth examples. How long do you need that Bluetooth data to be protected? You know, it can be a little weaker cryptography-wise because most of that information doesn't matter in a few minutes, let alone, you know, 10 years. So keep that in mind in your application, that a context is important. But with anything that's a stream cipher, we have a key. You can think of it as a primary key, the main thing that generates what actually does the encryption, the key stream. Key streams just XORed with the plain text, gives us ciphertext. Then that same key stream would also be able to reverse it, right? It's treated like a symmetric key. It would be able to reverse that process. Even if we don't store the key stream, it's always, reproducible from the original key, and then we can decrypt at that point. So that's kind of the idea with those stream ciphers. And in some ways, there's some things we can pick on, certain implementation details again. Part of the problem is, since this XORing is really so reversible, you know, that's good for us and bad for us for encryption. It's definitely good for us as an attacker, and it's still good for us as somebody defending our things. But we have to understand more about what this means. If this is reversible, just treated like a symmetric key, I'm going to have problems if I encrypt the same thing more than once. It's going to look the same. So we have that concept where we need something extra to force the key to be unique every time we're transmitting something that would be a duplicate plain text. Otherwise, we have, you know, like an operational security problem where, gee, when I see this traffic, this happens, and I know what that means. I'm going to see that because that duplication is going to show me more about context. So that's why we have that law of stream ciphers. If we ever use the same key twice, we're going to run into a problem where we can have a known plain text attack and get to something we don't have. Basically, the first thing you probably remember about WEP was the situation with initialization vectors. Your first exposure to WEP and cracking and improvements made basically becoming WPA, what was the value? Well, one of the things they did was they corrected some IV issues. They didn't have IVs in WEP. They just implemented it very badly. The initialization vector's purpose is to make the per packet key unique when it comes to WEP. And it's, again, this is RC4 also. It's not just WEP itself. We're just using WEP as an example. The idea, though, is if we had the same data, like an ARP request, in this case, going over WEP, it would not look the same every time if every time that packet was sent, we had a different initialization vector. Its purpose is similar to salt in a password hash. It is not the same thing, though. Don't confuse those details. But the goal is the same, so that the same encrypted data hashed in the password hash example, it doesn't look the same. It's the same purpose. So we have this initialization vector. It lets us reuse the key As long as we don't have a duplicate IV, then we don't have a duplicate key. So another way to think of it is an IV is an index into the key space. One of the issues that WEP had was it was also random. And random is good for confusion, but it's not so good for anti-repudiation and some other things when it comes to cryptography. Right? But we had this initialization vector. It would actually borrow some of the bits from the key and use those as an index. So you may have seen, like, some products would say 56-bit WEP, and some would say 64-bit WEP. And basically, the 56-bit was really 64-bit, but it was only 56 bits of strength because that was the length of the secret. Those other bits were used for the IV. So you see some documentation issues in that. So we have those considerations as we're looking here. The more space, the more bits we reserve for the initialization vector, the longer we can use that key before we're going to have to rotate it to something else or we change it. But the longer we make it, the less bits we have that are true security, because the initialization vector is often sent in the clear or is predictable in some way. Just for synchronization issues. Think about it. If the whole idea is we're encrypting something, well, where do we start with? Devices get turned on or an application begins, starts executing. What's the first initialization vector? You know, the receiving point or the decryption point has to know what was done. So it either has to be in the clear or it has to be determined ahead of time somehow. Or we have to have encryption to protect our encryption, right? We have to know that IV has to be protected somehow if we're going to protect it, which is why you basically always see in implementation the IV is in the clear or part of the spec, it's part of the specification. All right? We see some issues there. There were some, we'll talk about the crack attack later, but one of the big issues was that the IV can be reset to zero because that's what the Android, especially devices, would do when you power them off and start doing WPA2 again. It starts back at zero. Because what else are you going to do? You have to start somewhere. Random is bad here because of the potential for that birthday paradox, right? If it's random, we don't know necessarily when we're out of initialization vectors and need to rotate that key. So one of the things WEP had a problem with was it would collide, have duplicate IVs just by the randomness nature. One of the fixes to WEP when it became WPA was to make it sequential. And yes, although that was now predictable, it was good that it was predictable. As security controls, we could then tell if it was a duplicate, if it was accidentally or maliciously retransmitted. If sequential, we know that. We've already got that IV. Yes, it's not any improvement in security from the pure bits used to encrypt things, but now it was much harder to do the accelerated attacks with WEP because we've already seen those IVs. Those don't count anymore. Then we still have to deal with rotating when the time happens, but now it's better for the security of the application because we know we can observe that, we can predict it, we can handle it. Random is bad in this case. But that is the big question here, this final one on slide 10. Do multiple devices use the same key? How, you know, can they communicate if it's not in the clear? And that basically is why things are in the clear, why the IV is usually not encrypted, not really secret. All right? So we'll talk a little bit more about stream ciphers later, but let's also switch gears a little bit to block ciphers. The value in picking a block cipher usually is based on the application. What is it actually encrypting? For example, a stream cipher doesn't make a lot of sense to encrypt a hard drive because, if you change any of those bits on the hard drive, we have to re-encrypt the whole thing. Want to read it, we have to decrypt the whole thing. Doesn't make sense. You do it in blocks. And especially since the device actually reads in blocks anyway. It makes a lot more sense. So with a block cipher, just like the name implies, we do each block independently. we pad it out, if there isn't an even amount of data being encrypted, we pad it out in just encrypted form so that it is a 8-byte boundary. If it's a 16-byte block, it would be a 16-byte boundary, but it's at least 8 bytes. So if you see something that's block cipher encrypted, 64 bytes, well, it could have been 58 bytes. We don't know unless we go through and find some other information about the context of that data. All right? So your Rain Doll, your AES, DES, Triple DES, Blowfish, those are all potential things we have to try to, we're just blindly looking at something that's encrypted, trying to understand what encryption algorithm it is. It's going to be kind of hard if that's all we have to go on. That's why I say we usually find ourselves looking at patent information, maybe any other documentation to try to understand, even if it's not this application, what does the developer like to use? What does the company who developed this thing like to use? Maybe they use the same libraries to do the same encryption. And that's usually where you find most of the information about what is it really, unless you can do something like attach a debugger to it. You can see what's going on. Most of the time, when you do block cipher encryption, you are using one of these different modes. There are dozens of other kinds of modes that are slightly different than the three primary ones we talk about, but these three that we talk about are the basic ones, just again, slight tweaks to some of the things we talk about, would be something slightly different. This mode tries to solve a problem of some duplicate encryption as we see it. So we'll just dive right in. First, codebook mode. I've also seen accidentally, some people call this not just codebook, but cookbook. The idea is, though you're looking something up by reference because it's encrypted, it always looks the same when it's encrypted. Same plain text, same encrypted value. For example, here we have just a few bytes, and you can see here I show it highlighted in red, but you can see a repeating pattern if you look closely enough. This is an example of codebook mode, very classic replacement encryption, where it's a one-to-one. It can show you potentially interesting context. So if you see something like this, it could be repeating patterns, but we need to dig a little deeper. We have lots of padding or other things that are similar, like in looking at wireless applications, not just WEP, forget about WEP for a moment, but proprietary wireless things, where maybe it's an IoT device, Internet of Things style device, or something else that has some control, you might see zeros and ones represented in the waveform. And when it becomes in an encrypted digital form, you tend to see this pattern a lot in proprietary devices. Okay, and to illustrate it here, we're going to look at this. You can see this very bad, looks like a bad photocopy or a bad fax of something. Can anybody read what this is? It's a SANS logo, right? Yeah, if you read ahead, this next slide, 15, shows it up in the upper right. It's just a bad version of that. Well, this is just a visualization, AES ECB 128-bit encrypting that same logo. And you can see that, yeah, there are repeating patterns, right? That background is pretty much the same. You can even see a little bit about the stripes going across. We can see some other things. Great way to illustrate that, gee, even though we're encrypting it, there's still patterns. There's still duplicates. The same pixel encrypted the same over and over again is going to show up the same, right? So this is a great way to illustrate that. So yes, maybe we don't have zeros in our application, but if we're encrypting the same data over and over again in our application, it's going to show up like this. We can illustrate it with the logo. Josh Wright wrote this ECB encrypt image utility, which you can do this exact same demonstration. I find it works great. People saying, oh, we use AES, so we're okay. Check box on the compliance checklist that we're using AES encryption, and we're using 256. We're not even using 128. We're using 256. It's even more secure, right? But then you show This is what it looks like with your logo in the report, and it really illustrates the point that logo is not, you know, secret anymore if you can tell what it was. Now, it's a little bit of a scare tactic to try to do that because we're glossing over a lot of details, but it definitely drives the point that repeating patterns will still look the same when they're encrypted with ECB. There's nothing to make it different between pixel to pixel. If you want to use Josh's tool, you can grab it. You can play with it. He got lazy at the end and said it just has to be divisible by 4 pixel-wise, and it'll work. He just didn't. It's like, if you can't resize your image, maybe you shouldn't be using encryption analysis tools. But if you want to do that, it's a great way, again, to illustrate it. Doesn't work with images. Like, you take a, you know, a 4 million megapixel whatever image, that doesn't really do it justice because you do have slight variations in all those colors that it's capturing. So it works good with logos, not so much, you know, whatever you take a picture with your phone of a forest or something. There's going to be way too much difference. It doesn't really illustrate correctly. But it can be used for demonstrative purposes. So how do we fix ECB issues if that is our concern? Well, one thing we could do is we add something different to each block of text. And even if it is the same plain text block, it doesn't show up the same. And again, the idea is similar to salt and hashing in that we don't want it to repeat. But it's not really randomness. It's just an arbitrary extra factor added in. As long as we can reproduce that on the decryption reliably, it's not a problem really, right? So that's what we do in CBC mode, block chaining mode. We take something, this little circle with a plus sign is our XOR symbol. We do whatever we do for encryption, of course, but first we XOR the plain text with something to make it unique, and then we just have a different unique something every other time. Well, what do we have that's unique every time? If we are doing a chain of these, then every time we go through this, we should have a result of the ciphertext that should be unique, right? Because that was what we're trying to solve, is the repeating patterns. So we have a unique thing. We feed that into the next block, and there we go. This question marks, we don't literally send question marks, although you could, I guess. Reminds me of an old joke we used to play on the junior pen testers where we change all our passwords to asterisks, and then when they try to crack the password, it just shows asterisks. No, you don't have to use question marks as an initial, but that's basically treated the same as an initialization vector that we were talking about in stream ciphers. If we have one thing that we can use to make this encryption unique, we have to, again, either predetermine that or have it in the clear. But the idea is just as a blind look at this, oh, okay, these are all unique blocks. No longer shows the same pattern. This isn't perfect. There's problems with cipher block chaining, mainly efficiency. Again, kind of like we basically turn a block cipher into a stream cipher again. So we don't want to encrypt a hard drive this way again because we'd have to read something for block 3. We've got to go back and do all the other blocks. It depends on, right? Any corruption, like a bad bit, corruption on the hard drive is going to affect everything following, right? So we don't want to do this for hard drives, but it's a good, for certain applications, it might still be pretty good. Again, trying to treat something like a stream cipher, it still might be valuable. It's going to do the same job, showing that things aren't the same, as long as, again, we don't have the duplicate IV. We start having the duplicate IV, as we see these OpenSSL examples. Same IV, we still have the same problem. So it can still be useful, but not perfect. Also, too, like I said, it was is serial, that stream. We can't do like take advantage of multiple cores in our CPUs and do the encryption in parallel because it all depends on each other, right? We have to wait for the other block to be encrypted or decrypted to feed it into the next one. So one thing we could do is something more like counter mode. With counter mode, we have an IV, but the IV is more like a session IV, and we make that IV sequential. we concatenate it, this pipe between the IV and the counters representing concatenating. We concatenate the IV with a counter. So the block number now is added to that, and then we get the same uniqueness based on position of that block. We get something extra added, so it's no longer the same every time, solves the same thing. But the awesome thing about this is we can do it very quickly. We can do it fast. A corruption in one of these blocks is not going to affect another block. So much more resilient. We still have, you know, the potential if that IV, you know, is the thing that's triggering all this, how does it get synchronized? How does it get established? So we still have that question we always have to ask when it comes to assessing an application or device that uses encryption. You know, how does it start? How does that IV start? It's almost always going to be in the clear because that is always a question. Like you'd have to reboot all your devices at the same time, you know, and it would be confusing. All right. So we have to ask ourselves that. And then we also have to ask ourselves, well, before we start digging into this, what kind of algorithm do we think it is? Is it an odd length? It's probably a stream cipher. If it's divisible by 8, probably something like DES or something else. It could be a stream cipher, just a coincidence that it happens to land on the length of 8. If it's 16, it's probably AES, especially if it's not divisible by 8, only 16. So we can, you know, do a quick, this is what we think it is, but we want to confirm with documentation, you know. Even if it's not directly about our application, we might get a pretty good clue as to what is likely. Now, for hashes, there's a few different tools. There's actually like 4 different hash IDs that have been included on Kali Linux over the years. The one we're looking at here is pretty good. It'll look at whatever it is you stole. Say you're a pen tester, you break into a database, you see a field, or maybe you found a backup of something, you don't know what it is, and you're just like, what kind of a hash is this? You use this hash ID tool. It says, oh, that P between the $2 represents WordPress. It's how WordPress stores its MD5 or whatever. And it looks like it's in this format. All right. So I got a few of those, kind of give you some clues. But you'll see a lot that'll be kind of generic. Again, a lot of vendors like to use something normal and then just tweak it a little bit so that it doesn't quite fit the rules. So I would say expect like an 80% success rate with the hash ID tool. It's pretty conservative there, probably more than that, but expect an 80% and you'll probably get more like 90% success rate. And then we know a little bit about what we can work with here. We also have to ask ourselves, especially when vendors are cheating things, and I'm picking on them a lot right now because as a third party, we're always coming in and the vendor says it's encrypted, but we want to know for sure. And that's my job is to test all that out. So I have to ask myself, is it really encrypted? Or is it just obfuscated? That's usually the easiest thing for me to find out if I spend a little bit of time on it. If it's encrypted, it should always be random. You know, there shouldn't be a lot of metadata. There shouldn't be anything. One of the questions people usually ask is, well, if encryption is removing patterns and compression is removing patterns, how do I tell the difference? And really the answer is there's a little bit more metadata with compression, and that's about it. With encryption, there's not really a structure. It's just random. With compression, there'll be something that kind of is there. File names, like in the old zip format, we have the file names. Those are not compressed. That you can read those. Not a lot of other metadata, but there's a little bit. So there's a little tiny bit. Mathematically, yeah, there shouldn't be a lot, especially if you talk about, you know, gigabytes of information, and it's compressed. There won't be a lot of metadata. There'll be a little bit. It'll still look mostly random. But if it was encrypted, it'll be a little bit more random. Now, that is kind of hard to see. We use a couple of tools we'll look at, especially if it's not cleverly obfuscated and it's only slightly obfuscated. A histogram is going to show you those spikes in frequencies and things very quickly. And so I like to use that to start with. We even use this ENT tool to measure entropy. And for our purposes, when we talk about entropy, it's one way to measure randomness. sort of. I'm glossing over a lot of details, and some, you know, PhD in mathematic type people might argue with me on some terminology, and that's okay. I accept that that's not technically correct. But for our purposes, it is the same thing. We can measure how random something is, or maybe a better way to put it is the average distance between bits in a byte of our data we're looking at is entropy. So the closer to, in our purposes, we have 8-bit bytes, the closer we are to 8 is random, not so close to 8, not random. And we'll look at some examples shortly. But if we're looking at a high-level view, here we took some data and just piped in the bytes into a GNU plot to show us frequency. What might you suspect that this chart is showing us here? It's not encrypted, probably. I mean, there is a noise level, so there might be some encryption. There's a little, all these pluses that are average. That is a pretty average distribution for more than half, or about half, of the samples there. But yeah, we see some spikes. It doesn't seem to be encrypted. Well, what might you think it be? If that is the byte value, 0 all the way on the left, FF all the way on the right, what might you suspect that would be just on the spikes that you see, just out of curiosity? Anybody, I guess, ASCII? What kind of ASCII? Ah, yeah, now we're getting somewhere. Lowercase, right? Because this spike around 64-ish here would be a little bit closer to 4-something if it was uppercase. It's lowercase ASCII because 6-1 is our lowercase A, 4-1 is our uppercase A, right? If now we start thinking ASCII, what other things do we see that would help confirm that in this chart? What's the, let's see if my spotlight is working. It is. Now, if I can only calibrate, there it is. What's that plus? Yeah, that's about a hex 20, isn't it? That's probably an ASCII space. Yeah. And then what would these smaller peaks be? Not synchronized. What would these other ones be, probably? Like, what do you suspect that would be? It's really close to, it looks like about a ASCII 0. Hex 30 is our ASCII 0. I didn't mean to go there yet. If I had to guess, that's what I see. You also see some other smaller ones here, closer, 0D0A. Here's your turn new line, you know. Definitely confirming to me that this looks like just ASCII text on Windows, if I had to be a little more specific, because of the carriage return and new line. It could be HTTP. Excellent. Yeah, I like it. Thanks, Ron. Could definitely be HTTP. It's very likely, especially since the slide even tells you it's TCP. and also UDP as well. DNS, you know, probably wouldn't see as many symbols. There's a little too much noise in the symbol area. But the rest of that, what's that noise that we see in the rest of the line? That's going to be arbitrary bytes from packet header stuff, right? TCP header, IP header, probably. Because PCAP histogram is giving us everything for a packet capture. So there's going to be other noise in there. Not just binary data, but it's going to be structure data. So we can get a better idea if we try to analyze things without the structure that we know about, like an IP header, and see, we don't want to know if an IP packet is random. We want to know if the application inside of TCP, inside of IP, on the Ethernet frame is random. So if we peel off those layers, we'll get a better idea. But still though, one high-level histogram did give us a pretty good idea, maybe, that was not encrypted. Even if you don't know that it's lowercase ASCII, mostly, you could say that doesn't look encrypted, right? To get a little more specific, we can peel off those layers. Here we're looking at the TCPIC utility. We're reading in packet capture, and it's going to write out flows. The TCPIC utility will do much like if you've used Wireshark to select a packet, right-click, follow stream, or follow TCP conversation in other tools. That's basically what it's doing. Taking all those ACKs, combining them, and stripping off the header. So it's going to show data from the client perspective is the first file we see. Then we see the one on the server side for each conversation. Match out the ports, do all that for us. And now we can look at the embedded protocol. here using the ENT tool. This is, as I said, going to measure the entropy and some other things, but mostly we're concerned with the entropy, the distance between bits on average between every byte in that sample. An entropy of 1.8 is really hard to accidentally have. It basically means it's almost all the same bytes in that sample. Not just that, but most of the bits per byte are the same. So it's probably all very, very much the same data. We can look at it a little bit more. I mean, that's really hard. Like even the English language, upper and lower case, you're talking about a 7, mostly, if it is not just using just the primary things that people would use on letters pick on Wheel of Fortune or whatever, right, the common letters. If it's using everything, you'll get more like a 7, and it would be really hard to do something differently. Now, that works great for TCP traffic. What if it's not TCP? Well, we can use SCAPI. We'll do more SCAPI work tomorrow. We'll do just a little bit today. If you want to dig into that HTTP inject script that I wrote yesterday for the boot camp when you did the MITM proxy tool, it's got some SCAPI work in there, very simple SCAPI stuff, where it'll deal with some of those headers for you. Since it's aware of IP and embedded protocols, we can let SCAPI do that, peel it out, and we can look at that embedded protocol. All right, here is an example. Definitely want to stress this. If you're not a Python person and you haven't done Python interactively, maybe you've only used scripts before, this might look a little weird, but we're running SCAPI just as if we're running an interactive Python prompt. And then we create a file handler, a file pointer, not really a file pointer, but a file handler object. We define a handler for the import. This is basically like a PCAP filter, more or less. And we can sniff, even though we're not sniffing live off the wire, we're sniffing from a packet capture. Now we define this function named handler. What's right underneath, I just have to specify this because you're going to use an exercise later, soon. What is underneath this DEF space? Anybody want to tell me what would be here that doesn't really print well? No, it's spaces. It is not a tab. It's a joke. We can pick on that. You can use a tab, but you'd be wrong. It's always spaces. No one's going to challenge me on that? No? All right. Yeah, yes, I am right. It's spaces. Yes. It's probably easiest with, you don't know if it's tabs or spaces, to tick the spaces, is my opinion. And when I'm coming into a situation where I don't know if an environment, like if people have their own scripts, I'm doing assessments, if they're using spaces or tabs, I find I get less problems if I just stick to spaces. So that's my reason. Yes, you can set your editor when tab will inject spaces, and there's lots of other things. But anyway, whatever you use for this, just keep it the same. You guys can argue with the instructors tomorrow about tabs and spaces when it comes to Python. But anyway, you're not typing these, right? This is your prompt, your greater thans. That's your Python interactive prompt. And then when you start this, when you have the colon that defines, delineates the end of the function name here, it's going to give you those dot, dot, dots, and you will put in four spaces or a tab if you would like to really do it wrong. You can do that. I'm joking. A tab will work. And then you have a blank line, right? You don't put in spaces, you just do a blank line, and that ends that definition. So I stress that because I haven't really talked about Python specifics on that. That's tomorrow morning, but that will get you started for using this. And now we can use SCAPI to peel that off. As long as SCAPI can identify what all the packets and embedded protocols are, this could be IPv4 over IPv6 over whatever, as long as it can figure it out because it's normal, we can just say packet.payload.payload.payload till we get the layer we want, and eventually we'll get the data we want. We just have to keep going. That's one of the awesome things about SCAPI. All right? So, then I have found that some vendors will encrypt something or obfuscate it, and they just put it, it's IP over IP. For something very simple. And it's just the default tool that we use to crack that thing doesn't look for nested IP. And we just have to go and peel that off and now, oh, look, it's really not encrypted or not all that clever. Our first exercise of the day is just going to be looking at some of those encrypted versus compressed situations. So not very complicated, pretty quick. You'll be on your Kali Linux, log in, go to the root lab day two folder. You'll see three packet captures that you can play with. I'm not going to demonstrate it because it's exactly what we just had in the previous slides, which were pictures. So you've got the ENT tool, and you've got that PCAP histogram. The one that is the Python script Josh has in there, it's pretty useful, but it's a lot slower than the Perl version. There's just some situation with the Perl version. Actually, under some conditions, the graph gets skewed. It's got a bug in it from, at least with a recent, I think it's a recent Perl big integer thing that wasn't a problem 5 years ago, but in some supporting library it is now. Anyway, use whatever tools you want. If you just want to follow what's in the book, you can. But stop and try to say, gee, is that encrypted or not encrypted for those three files? I'll just take a few minutes to do this exercise and then we'll resume. You know, that some people still sometimes ask, well, why 8? Why is 8 the magic number? It's 8 bits per byte. If you want to think about it in different ways too, like we have I have on the screen here that Rocky word list, uncompressed, entropy is measured at 5. This takes like a few seconds depending upon your laptop speed, of course. But what is in the Rocky password list? You know, every password is separated by a new line, but we also have, you know, those passwords that were breached. So a lot of simple English words, some symbols, some numbers, but mostly lowercase. And it makes sense that roughly, you know, half of the bytes, half of the bits, because we're using half the bytes, the printable part of ASCII range is going to be a little bit on this side of halfway. So that's why it's 5 point something. That's just that one. If you want to do the a comparison of something a little more random, I guess you could do it a couple different ways. Like, for example, here, I just grabbed 1 kilobyte, you know, 1,024 bytes from DevU random, saved it to a file, and if you run ENT on that, you know, we get pretty close to 8 when it comes random. You start talking 7999, that's pretty close to random. I'm kind of curious on how much better I can get. But, you know, given that I have enough sample size, if I only do like, you know, 10 random bytes, that's not gonna measure nearly as well, right? Because it's just not a large sample set. So keep that in mind. Everything about all of our crypto work today, comes to real world pen testing and crypto, it's all about context. You know, an application, like how was it actually used? So when you look at something, you see something small, yeah, you know, don't think everything's going to be the same if it's extreme small amount of data. Anyway, when it comes to comparing it to larger groups of data. Let's get back to the slides. All right, so you should have seen something similar to this. See a little bit of ASCII range on the first capture one file and a little more time involved to process the second file. It's bigger, but you're going to see a much more random noise level. And then we see just something obscured on 3, right? It looks like things have been shifted over to the different range of bytes, but it still looks roughly the same as the things we're looking at before. There's a, you know, something like the space is also there. So it might just be a XORed or moved over. Who knows? We haven't looked at those details yet, but just from a cursory look, doesn't look like it's very well encrypted, does it? All right. So doing the math on that, get to some of those examples. We see that our English language tends to be in printable ASCII form, something that's slightly above 5. So that's pretty typical. And we can do those commands to see our results. Now, if you haven't done this part yet because you can't type to do it, you may be asking yourself, how do I know how many payloads to put there? Well, it's trial and error usually. If this is some obfuscated thing, some vendor throwing data encrypted in IP or TCP or something, you keep going as deep as Scapy will, and then you keep looking for it. Okay? Once you get to something, you'll know it. Every application is probably going to be different, though. Right? And that's really the point, is to dive in and just, we don't know what we're looking for yet, and just say, gee, is this encrypted, compressed? Again, the difference between compressed and encrypted is probably pretty minimal from the math. You have to look at the actual data, like pipe it to XXD and see, is there anything, maybe even run it through strings, the strings command, and just say, is there anything that looks like framework data, like metadata? And then it's probably compression, not encryption. At least, looks like an envelope around the actual encryption, maybe. Something like that. All right? You're going to have to dig a little deeper to get further. All right. So we're going to walk through this bit flipping attack, and then we'll take a break. The bit flipping attack is I like it because it's a great example of control. When it comes to the fundamental, like philosophical things within an attack, where does the attacker have control? We usually think of that as being input that's not filtered. That's what the attacker controls, right? They can put in symbols and do an SQL injection or cross-site scripting or something like that, command injection, because they control the input. Well, if an attacker has some visibility to this application, they might be able to use a bit-flipping attack to corrupt and infer what's going on in the decryption process. Using that inference, they might be able to change the ciphertext to decrypt in a way that would be more successful back to a corrupted plaintext. Since in CBC mode, we have this feedback. Earlier, we had a chart that showed the encryption process. This is the equivalent decryption process, where the resulting ciphertext is used to re-XOR after the decryption routine and get us back to the original plaintext. If we corrupt this second block, what does that affect? It doesn't affect the first one, obviously, in the ciphertext. And we might corrupt this block, and this decryption routine in the middle of this slide would result in bad plaintext. But the point we're illustrating is, if I corrupt that block, I also corrupt a specific one here. And since the decryption all happens, and whatever very elite math is going on that is not reversible at that point, when it gets to XOR, it is reversible, right? The whole value of encryption is really, it's just, again, too expensive to reverse in normal time. But once we get to XOR, that's what XOR is awesome at, is being really easy to reverse. It's so simple, and it's fast. It's amazing. XOR is a magical thing. It's just so simple. So since that happens, if I corrupt the ciphertext, I might be able to corrupt the plaintext. Now, why would that matter? Well, if I can start seeing how this happens, I might be able to infer what the key is being used in that decryption following. So it's better probably to illustrate this with an example. I'll show you this post-auth one here, and then you'll be doing the a slightly different one for your exercise shortly. So I'm going to switch to Kali and pull this up. Let me answer that question with putting it back up on the screen, because it's probably important for other people to hear that too. And I like to say that if you ever have a question, you hesitate on asking it, chances are somebody else in the room also has that question. So anyway, I'm going to point out the and rephrase your question, if you don't mind. Question was, why doesn't this corruption that we show in the middle, that red, why does it not affect the other blocks? It does. You're right. But that's not the point that we're zeroing in on. What we're going to do is we're going to use the inference of a specific corruption to infer what the key byte is that corresponds to the byte we corrupted in the solid. We're focusing on one at a time. There is a side effect, yes, that this plain text would be decrypted incorrectly, and following everything will be decrypted incorrectly as well, potentially. The application may or may not make it easy to see that, but yes, the decryption part itself, we're not just only affecting these two red blocks that are in the chart. We are doing that, but this is what we care about. The red one is our goal, If we can corrupt that, then we can infer what the plain text was XORed with, which would have been the key to decrypt from the ciphertext. So good question. All right. Important enough that I wanted to switch back to that screen. All right. So back to Kali. I have Kali browser open. Let's see if Zoom's working pretty well. Nice. Okay. So, yeah. All right. So I'm going to show you on post-auth. You'll be using a different one. So basically, this is, you know, one of your world's crudest proof of concepts, because we don't want to mess with other things in the application. We want to focus on the actual encryption part. So definitely just proof of concept. Let's say we've logged in and we're in this application. We can see an IV and we can see an encrypted value for the session. All right. We don't necessarily know this is what it is, but it's a contrived example to prove our point, right? You might have to go through and do a trial and error to find out what it is, and you suspect that, well, maybe this session is something encrypted. I see this is an IV. It's labeled IV. It's almost always labeled IV. Yeah, an application might hide that somehow, name it something different, but it's going to be a little bit of a trial and error. So a couple things I can do. Basically, I'm trying to change my privileges in this situation. Sorry, I'm trying to click off of that so it's easy to read. So we even have a handy link for starting over for trial and error. You wouldn't always have that in your application, right? But it says we're Sue, and our user ID is 100, and a group ID is 100, and we have limited permissions. If we can get UID 1, we would get better privileges. So how would I change my 100 to a 001 is really our goal. So what I'm going to do is use a corruption in the IV to flip the bit and infer with a little bit of XORing what that keystream byte was so that I can change it to something that would give me the same result. So first I have to find out what bytes I'm dealing with. So I'm not going to be real clever at first because it kind of is easy to do. I'm going to use uppercase, it's a little easier to see, and just corrupt the first byte with FF. And what did that decrypt to? Hello, UE. So it changed that capital ASCII S to a capital ASCII U. Maybe if I zoom out a little bit, let me. Yeah, it's pretty easy to read still. Problem is, it's following the mouse. So, all right. I'm going to leave that corrupted for now. I don't really care about that, but let's fish a little further and let's replace A1 with FF. Now what happened? I changed that ASCII space to an ASCII E. So I'm going to go start over. So I'm a little bit there. Instead of A1, I'll go to EC, replace that with FF. And now whatever I did changed that ASCII 1, which, what's an ASCII number 1? Hex-wise, it's represented as hex 31. I don't know why I said 30. 0 is 30. 1 is 31, right? And we ended up with a double quote. So what is a double quote on the ASCII chart? Who's the fastest to type man space ASCII? It's hex. No one's going to say? You don't even have to look it up in the man page. You could do Python. So I'm going to do an interactive Python shell here. And yes, it's Python 2, but which is what I had already typed. So if I wanted to print something, and I could say print the ordinal of something like a double quote, I have to escape it. There we go. 3-4 in decimal, and I can use that hex function in Python. Hex 22, yes. So I heard someone say that, but yes, it is. Hex 22 is that double quote. All right, so what I ended up with, I did a FF. I corrupted that byte with FF, and it resulted in a 22. So there's something in the keystream, the resulting encryption, decryption also, that results when XORed, comes up to a 2-2 with the FF. So if I wanted to reverse that particular part, this isn't the whole story, but if I wanted to do that, I could just do it here. I could say print hex 0x22, and XOR in Python's a caret, and 0xFF. And I get 0xDD. So that is the byte that was used after, if you go back and look at that chart, the byte that was used after when I start having that corruption applied, that's the point where I'm at. So if I have this, I could even go back to say, what was the original? I had, it was EC, right? I better prove it. If I click to start over, yes, it was EC. Those are the bytes I replaced. So if I go back to my terminal again, and I print EC with the 0x31, I should get the same answer, right? I did. Okay. So now I know I've corrupted the byte. I've got my math right as far as this. I have, although I switched, this was the byte I corrupted with that byte, and this was the result. I can do this math to get to the right place. I can say, all right, if I got that 0DD, and I wanted to XOR that, and what I wanted that 3-1 to be a 3-0, to change that 1 to a 0, that would be off this direction. Basically, if we do this hex XORing, what I want to come to is, all right, if I do a 0x ED with the original byte, which was EC, type, there we go, I get that one byte off literally. So I use this way to have the XORing go from the IV XORed with the keystream byte to get that resulting of 1. So basically, if I go back to my web browser and I replace this ED, I did FF, EC, with ED, I get a 0, an ASCII 0. Right? Now, if we're doing this in ASCII because it's easier to see, but if we're doing this in binary, I'd have to be using hex editors and look at the actual, you know, maybe use Wireshark to see the capture. Just keep that in mind that when I'm doing this, and if you make a little off a mistake, it might look really weird because of alignment or it's non-printable. And this is PHP. So it acts really weird sometimes, and you might actually notice that. If it sees something, it can't tell if it's true, it might say, well, it must be false, you know, or it's not false, it must be true. PHP will make decisions like that. So if we corrupt certain bytes and it's doing ASCII string comparisons, we might find ourselves in a situation that the MySQL server utility was in a few years ago. You may remember what the vulnerability I'm talking about, where it would stop comparing the password hash after a certain byte sequence because it was terminating, and basically 1 in 300 attempts would get you into the MySQL account. This was a CVE from 2 years ago, I think. Anyway, I was able to change that to a 0, and I don't need to change the 0 to a 0. I can leave that one. That's that E1. But the AF I can change. I make it FF, and I get a backtick. So to do the math and continue this one out, we have our backtick. I'm trying to Alt-Tab, but it's not going to do it for me here. Terminal. Not a new terminal. This terminal. And I already forgot what I said. What was it again? I can go look it up. I'm going to zoom out. Getting vertigo. I don't know about you guys. All right. So it's AF. I replaced with FF and got the back tick. All right. So I'm going to say print hex of the, well, I'm actually going to do ord of the back tick. Left out a parenthesis, so hex 60. Did I escape it? That doesn't sound right. No, I guess that is right. And XOR that with 0xAF, I get CF. So if I do a CF with what I want, which is a 0x 3-1, I get an FE. Let's see if I did my math right. And replace this FF with AE? Oh, FE. No, that was right, AE. I have to fix the EC with what I found before, which was ED. And now I got my 001. And now it says, welcome, super user. So, even if you didn't track exactly what I did, because I did a lot of XORing quickly and verbalized it and said a lot of, like I enunciated a lot of hex. So I don't expect everybody to go, oh yeah, now I can always break that. That's why we have an exercise. So in your exercise, you could redo this one if you want. It's just at crypto.6660.org. But your true exercise is to use the other one, the sessionauth.php. It's a little different. But it's the same general concept. You're going to be changing from, it even prints it out, so you don't even have to do the ORD for you. You're going to be changing your user ID from 20 to 00. And you can, again, cheat on this because PHP does a bad job of comparison. So you might find yourself not surgically winning, but hacking winning still. Nonetheless. All right, so that's your exercise. It's crypto.6660.org, sessionhandler.php. All right, it's time for us to resume again. This one's not too hard unless you get off of alignment. The only real mistake I see people usually make with this is they get off by half of a byte. If you got off by half of a byte, you're actually corrupting 2 bytes in a less than predictable way. You think you're just corrupting one with a capital FF, for example, but then it corrupts 2 bytes. Especially if it changes like a space to a non-printable ASCII, you don't immediately notice that. And that's usually if somebody has something go wrong, how they do it. And you can be very Neanderthal with this, and you don't even have to stop and think about XORing. You could just keep trying bits. And many of you did have some success, which is there because it is, even though it's proof of concept, contrived example, very real problem that things like authentication checks will stop their string comparisons if there's something that terminates that string or is interpreted differently. So very real problem. We're picking on PHP at the moment, but it's not just PHP. I mentioned the MySQL auth problem from a couple of years ago was pretty big deal. 1 in 300 attempts would collide you with a test that would actually work. Pretty easy to brute force that in a tiny loop. But you can go through and do both the examples we did, the one I demonstrated, the post auth and the session handler, both similar, but this one we're trying to go to a UID of 0. It's a little easier to accidentally get to a 0 than like breaking this, but not breaking it in a surgical way and breaking it so that it still gives you those access to the comics in this case as a reward for breaking through. We're going to keep going, but sometimes people ask me, like, how realistic is this? I mean, how often do you see this with the CBC bit flipping? And if you peel away all of the CSS and other things that happen in something like a website, it's a lot easier to recognize this. It does happen sometimes. It's not usually a encrypting of the username and encrypting the whole text that we see here. But we often do see certain things like the actual numbers and pass permissions basically represented with a number, a UID those kind of things do happen. Just not, we had to, in this contrived example, have other text to encrypt, so we also did the username. Most applications that I've seen anyway will just do the ID and some other timestamp information, not so much the English language for username, but still pretty close to the reality there. All right. So based on what you do find yourself running into, you might be able to take advantage of that. Again, not always that even that difficult, because often there's not even a cycle blockchain where the encryption that's happening is just using our old codebook model, so that it just is literally you could log in, see what it is, and clone a session ID for somebody else and still have that other vulnerability. But this was a good example of the CBC bit flipping. Anyway. All right. The next thing we're going to talk about is a little more of an art, in a way, because we're inferring something we can't actually see. And I should say it's an art because to do it quickly and to make good use of it, you have to recognize that it's happening. And basically, you wouldn't even know that there's an Oracle padding issue, which is our next example here, unless you can tell the difference between a padding error, a decryption error, an application error, and a protocol error. So you might have all of that hidden behind a website where it strips out all the error messages. You have no idea why something didn't work. And we can't use this attack. The whole thing about an Oracle padding attack is we're using something as an Oracle, a way to infer what's actually there, but we can't see it. If that error message isn't obvious to us, we're blind to that. And I like to actually use this example. It's a lot like an SQL blind injection attack. A blind SQL injection attack is very similar here. We don't necessarily see exactly what's happening, but we can infer what did happen. As a refresher on that, since I brought it up, an SQL injection attack, if it's a blind one, we don't see the answer of our query, but we can change the behavior of a page. Or maybe we see that the timing is different on the query, something like that. We don't directly see the result, but we use it to know what was actually being executed. And that's similar to an Oracle here, where something that kind of leaks out the information. And it's not going to be as obvious. That's why we call it an Oracle. It's a lot like the mythological oracles, you know, that would give you very confusing but technically correct in hindsight clues about the future is the idea. This gives you something that in hindsight you say, yep, that was exactly right, but it may not be immediately obvious when you first see it. That's kind of the idea. So basically, we have to have a couple of things, as I mentioned. One thing, we have to be able to tell the difference of the error messages. And two, there actually has to be padding. Otherwise, we can't do an Oracle padding attack. And yes, this is, Oracle is something that gives us clues. This isn't necessarily a database attack like Larry Ellison's company, Oracle, although that might be involved in a way. This is really just any application that has, again, padding errors, we might be able to use that to leak out information. Let's look at some examples. This could be PKCS 5 or 7. It doesn't really matter. It works basically the same way. Since we're doing block encryption, we pad it out to the next 8-byte boundary in this example. And if we had exactly 8 bytes, we add a block of padding entirely. The idea is, since we have to pad out to 8-byte blocks anyway, we might as well get some ancillary benefit. We'll pad it in a way where we can detect end of data corruption. We can't, something in the middle might get corrupt, we have no idea. But it's the very end of the block, the last block that we're looking at, we might detect something wrong. So we see here we've got 4 bytes we're encrypting, Josh, right there in ASCII. We have 4 bytes of padding to pad it out to 8 bytes. And with the padding bytes, they always are the value of how many padding bytes there should be. Makes it very easy to work right to left by an application can tell if there's a padding corruption. So with 4 bytes. That leaves us 4 bytes of data. We have 4 bytes of padding. We have a 5-byte that we're encrypting here, Bryce. We have 3 threes because that's what's left. So if any one of those 3 threes were not threes, then we know that there's been a padding corruption and the application would be able to have a padding error of some kind and know that something's wrong. You know, we weren't able to get the end of the block correctly. Stephen leaves us with 1. If we had more than those 8 bytes, it's only the last block that has the padding. And as I said, if you have exactly 8, you always have to have padding. So that leaves us 1 block of all padding at the end. Of course, that also means that it's very easy for an application to say, if that last byte is ever greater than 9, there's a problem, right? Because there's no way to have more than 8 bytes of padding. Something's corrupt. If any one of these 8 eights are corrupt, we know there's been a problem. So you can have your application enumerate that. Well, how do we take advantage of this is the question, not just how it works necessarily. Basically, if our application is giving us padding errors, we can damage, kind of like the bit flipping exercise, we can damage some of these bytes to see if we can get a padding error or not to find out what the keystream byte actually was. Okay? So as a hypothetical, let's say our application authenticates username and password. It's encrypted with a single key. Also, the application decrypts with that same key. And we see that the IV is present in clear text. That's our context. What do we do with this? We look at it like this. We have our IV. We've got 16 bytes encrypted as ciphertext. And so we're basically looking at what we can do with it. Now, here on this walkthrough slide number 3, slide 53, we have our keystream data in gray. The attacker doesn't know that. It's just happening. Also doesn't know what the plain text is. But the user can see the resulting stuff on the screen. You can see the ciphertext. You can see the initialization vector. Again, we said it was in the clear. Now, if the attacker changes the initialization vector to change the decryption in this web app in this example, they can probably get a padding error unless this magically coincides, these last bytes, with it'd have to be, very unique chances, but it might collide with something valid, but chances are the attacker is going to get an error message, which is fine. That's what we want. We use an error message here to find out what that should be. So we start off with all zeros. It makes life a little easier. We get a padding error. And we expect that as the attacker. We expect that the initial IV of all zeros with the same ciphertext that we got with a different initialization vector, we shouldn't get the same result. It should be an error. All right. So we don't care about what it decrypted to, but we care about that padding error. So we get a padding error with all zeros. What we want to do then is find out this last byte in the IV, the least significant byte here, if we can make that, whatever byte would make this a not padding error, there should only be one possible byte that would give us not an error. And what would that end up with? Well, instead of this plain text down here that's a hex 5C at the very bottom, if that results in a 1, we have precisely 1 byte of padding, and I should not get a padding error. I may get a decryption error. I might get an application error. I might get something else. But I don't get a padding error. Everything else will give me a padding error. If the application shows me those errors, then I know whatever I change this to that resulted not to an error ended up with a 1. And now I can XOR those back to find out what it was XORed with to know what that last byte of the keystream was. And so we can walk through this. So let's try a 1, it gives us a padding error. We try a hex 02, gives us a padding error. Eventually, the attacker tries a 5D, does not get a padding error, which means the padding was a success, resulted in a 1, although we don't see it. We know that's the only possibility of not getting a padding error. And then we say, what XORed with 1 gives us 5D? Well, it happens to be 5C. We just reverse the XORing, and now we know what that keystream byte was.